For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The answer has profound and wondrous are is rarely met with even in 100,000 million helpers. Now I can see and hear it, accept and
good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to have with us, giving the talk this morning, as our guest teacher, Jiwa Woodbury. Thank you for coming, Jiwa. Jiwa is a practitioner in a Tibetan tradition, but steeped in the Dharma also, and is also a Zen hospice worker, an eco-psychologist, environmentalist in various ways, and he's been doing a very interesting work. I mentioned this last spring, his article on planetary hospice, looking at, as a hospice worker, stages of individual grief and process of dying, and applying that to our own responses and process of responses to the difficulties of climate and other environmental damage that I've spoken of here. And his most recent article is called Climate Catharsis, and really excellent. And so, Jiwa, thank you for coming, and please.
Thank you. Yes, I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to share with all of you this morning the sacred space. And a little bit of the insights and thoughts and ideas on climate psychology.
Excuse me for a second. Do you need a chair?
Yeah.
No, this cushion there, and you can go around, or you can go around to these cushions here. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Jim.
And I really appreciate everyone making an effort to be here during the holidays. I'm sure there's other places that we could be this morning, and I really appreciate your intention in being here. I'd like to begin with by quoting Taigen Den, actually, from a paper, an essay that he wrote on, I believe it was entitled, The Whole World's Hair is on Fire, Climate Change. And in reading that essay, this sentence really resonated with me. That I'm going to share with you. Taigen Den says that Buddhist practice confirms that awareness is transformative, both individually and collectively. That sounds like a simple statement at first, but it's really quite profound. And I think everything that I'm going to share with you this morning is basically unpacking that statement, and everything relates back to that. So I'm going to read it again. Buddhist practice confirms that awareness is transformative, both individually and collectively. So to begin with, well, I suppose we could begin with Buddhist practice, which is essentially everything that we do in the world until we become a Buddha. But the question of awareness is one that that I find infinitely interesting. How that term is used in so many different ways, in so many different contexts, even from one school of Buddhist thought to another. And so I want to begin by really carefully discussing what I mean when I use the term awareness in the context of eco-psychology and climate psychology. And from a Zen perspective, I'll begin here. We have Dogen's three stages of enlightenment, which are defined as thinking, not thinking, and non-thinking. And of these three stages, the last stage of non-thinking, or pre-reflective consciousness, or concentration in the absence of thought, is what I think of as awareness. We have a similar parallel construct in Tantra, known as the three levels of consciousness. And the three levels of consciousness are gross consciousness, subtle consciousness, and extremely subtle consciousness. And I think these are pretty equivalent to Dogen's three stages of thinking, or gross consciousness, not thinking, which would be equivalent of subtle consciousness, and non-thinking, or extremely subtle consciousness. So the and there's also then, from a Jungian depth psychology viewpoint, three levels of mind that line up nicely with these three levels of consciousness, or three stages of enlightenment. And those are personal consciousness, which would be the same as gross consciousness in Tantra, or thinking. The personal unconscious, which would be the equivalent from a Tantra standpoint of subtle consciousness. And from Dogen, not thinking. In other words, the things that perhaps drive our actions that we are not conscious of. And the collective unconsciousness, which is from a Buddhist or from a Tantra standpoint, extremely subtle consciousness. The extremely subtle consciousness, or non-thinking mind, in its purest form, is referred to as the clear light nature of mind. Also referred to as pristine pure awareness or original nature, or original nature. So awareness is more a force of nature than it is something that we traditionally or reflexively would think of as our mind. And more impersonal than personal. So Jung's collective unconsciousness is not something that's personal to us, but something that we experience from the collective archetypes, sort of a collective pool or reservoir. And it's something that we all have access to, but tends to be obscured by thinking or even not thinking. You can think of awareness as a vast ocean in which consciousness swims. So you might be wondering why I'm beginning here in a talk about the climate crisis. And the reason is that awareness is not only what connects us to one another and to all sentient beings, like our pets. I think we've all experienced shared awareness with animals. But also it's what connects us to our own true nature. And it's what connects us to nature itself. So by losing touch with our own true nature, we lose our connection to the natural world. And conversely, by losing touch with the natural world, we lose touch with our own true nature. I'm convinced this is the root cause of the climate crisis. The climate crisis is a symptom of a disease in our relation to nature. And awareness holds both the cause and the cure for that disease. So everything else that I say here today will relate back to this idea that the climate crisis is a crisis of awareness. And this is true both individually and collectively. So any crisis, any personal crisis that you or I might experience in relation to climate change, can be resolved by non-thinking, by resting in the vast realm of pure awareness. And that's not a very Western way of thinking about the climate crisis, but the Western ways of thinking about the climate crisis haven't been very effective. Everything that I'm going to share, everything that I've expressed in various scholarly papers and in the book that I'm writing, which is directed to more mass audience, emerged from this realm of non-conceptual awareness reached in meditative absorption. And I mean that quite literally. Even in the writing process, I begin on the cushion. From a non-conceptual aware state of awareness. And I guess because of my experience in karma or whatever, all of these ideas have sort of come up from the cushion. And I don't feel like a very strong sense of authorship over these ideas. I've had a lot of really amazing teachers and from the Buddhist path and in the worldly path as well, from a lifetime of environmental activism. So we need to really trust our experience of awareness above all else. So with that as sort of context, I'd like to tell you a story. And it's the story of the American dream. Once upon a time in America, people lived close to nature. There were certainly big cities in those days, but mostly there were small towns and family farms, and people knew where their food came from and how it was grown. These people also had some funny ideas about taming nature and trying to grow things in places where those things didn't really belong. And nature turned on us. And a Great Depression came to pass when food became scarce. And this natural trauma was followed rather closely by the trauma of World War, when we were forced to face down the worst in human nature. And in response to all this struggle with nature, we did something that changed everything. We fundamentally altered nature at a place called Trinity, assuming control over the forces of creation itself. And we unleashed hell on earth in the land of the rising sun. And here's how one human being described his experience of witnessing the first atomic explosion in the desert at Trinity. Suddenly there was an enormous flash of light, the brightest light I have ever seen or that I think anyone has ever seen. It blasted. It pounced. It bored its way into you. It was a vision which was seen with more than the eye. It was seen to last forever. You would wish it would stop. Altogether, it lasted about 2 seconds. That was the description from a gentleman named Isidore Isaac Rabbi. And I truly believe he was speaking here more from our collective consciousness than from his own. I think that's what he was expressing when he said it was a vision seen with more than the eye, and this vision bored its way into our collective consciousness. When we split the atom, I think we split ourselves off from the natural world and from our own true nature. And we immediately began to insulate ourselves from nature in a new creation we called suburbia, which was an artificial world with manicured lawns and plastic everything. And we fell into a deep sleep we called the American dream. Now, the natural response to loss is grief. And we can be sure that the grief we felt in response to losing our intimate connection to nature, to the natural world, was profound. But there was no place for this, for the expression of this grief in the American dream. It's possible, and I think understandable even, that we were suffering from grief overload after two world wars sandwiched around the Great Depression. But we also had institutionalized death by this time. Death and dying no longer happen in people's homes. One further and powerful expression of the rupture in our human nature was very telling. Mothers actually stopped nursing their children, substituting technology in the form of plastic bottles and formulas for the warmth and intimacy of a mother's breast. I think we can begin to appreciate how collective pathology manifests in response to something as traumatic as being separated from the natural world. So that's the story, and here's the theory that flows from that story. We've been collectively and individually repressing this natural grief ever since. And it is built up to this critical point in time where it is full-on existential crisis. It's a crisis of spirit. Our psyche is sick. And either we succeed in waking up from this dream by reconnecting with our true nature, or we will surely die in our sleep. Now, grief unfolds in stages, and at each stage, the suppression of our natural collective grief has resulted in widespread mental illness, often described as epidemics. Beginning in the 1950s and 60s, we were at the first stage of collective grief, which is denial. Everything was just fine, everything was okay, and everybody was very attached to that idea. And we had an epidemic and anxiety. The number of prescriptions for anxiety in the form of Valium and other drugs was just grew phenomenally during that time. The second stage, I'm going to go through these pretty quickly because we're limited in time here, but the second stage of denial is anger. And in the 60s, towards the end of the 60s and the 1970s, we definitely became an angry society. And we even externalized this sort of idea of being disconnected from nature by waging ecological warfare in Southeast Asia. And we brought that war home into the streets. And we saw an epidemic in depression. And from a psychological standpoint, depression is what happens when you suppress anger. So we were expressing anger, but we were expressing it in a dysfunctional way, sort of transferring the anger, the natural anger of seeing how our lifestyle was actually starting to have devastating environmental consequences, devastating impacts on the natural world. And we didn't really know how to express that anger, and it got expressed in all these other ways. And at the same time, we started to get past the denial of realizing something was wrong with the way we were living in the world. And we started addressing some of the symptoms of that illness. And there was even a period of time, I think, when we started to take really constructive action and to be less dysfunctional. We elected a farmer to be president, which is really pretty remarkable. A peanut farmer became president after we threw Nixon out of office. And he installed solar panels at the White House. And he told us not only that we needed to address the oil, our oil addiction, but he actually, I think, quite accurately identified this national collective illness as malaise, which is another word for depression. And it was pretty much in response to that, that we went back, we kind of got off that constructive path and went back into our dysfunctional path. It was with Ronald Reagan, it became Morning in America, and we sort of like reaffirmed the idea of denial and that everything was okay and suppressed the anger again. And actually, at that same time, we became aware of something else that was just like quite remarkable and again really changed the whole dynamic here, which was that the impacts we were having on the natural world were no longer local. All of a sudden, we were told that the tropospheric ozone layer was disappearing because we were using hairspray. I mean, really, that was, you talk about cognitive dissonance, the idea that something as mundane and everyday as the way we took care of our hair and, was destroying the protective layer of the planet. This is like a remarkable, unprecedented kind of psychological statement. And this kicked off the third stage of collective repression of grief, which is bargaining. We became obsessed with security and amassing wealth and basically trying to compensate for the insecurity of thinking that life was threatened and in jeopardy by trying to secure our lives and our futures with gated communities and scramble for wealth and a fascination with the lifestyles of the rich and famous and celebrity and all of this, came up at this directly after this sort of new reality became apparent. And it wasn't long after the tropospheric ozone layer started disappearing, the ozone hole, which we made light of and tried to, Al Gore at that time was known as the ozone guy, and it was just we were acting in sort of very dysfunctional ways towards that new information, and then global warming also started to become part of our new awareness. And so all of a sudden we became a threat to the natural world. It was no longer just being out of balance or sort of having polluting, like having devastating impacts on rivers and streams. All of a sudden we were actually threatening the natural world. And the illness that resulted from that was narcissism. Really, we basically experienced an epidemic in narcissism beginning in the 1980s and into the 90s. I'm not sure we've quite escaped that one yet, but and this is, basically our compensation for insecurity. And then around the fourth stage, And this bargaining stage has elevated itself. It's started out sort of with people's 401ks and gated communities and Humvees, you know, like all these different ways of trying to secure our lifestyle and our future. And now I think that's gone filtered up to the global stage with all the political leaders scrambling and for limited resources. And that's, I believe that our political leaders are trapped in that bargaining stage. And I think everyone else has moved on to the fourth stage of suppressed grief, which is depression. And we have a very strong fear and aversion to the idea of depression. We think of depression as being something that's to be avoided at all cost. And of course, clinical depression is not what I'm talking about here. That's a different thing. What I'm talking about is just the depression of realizing that things are spinning out of control. Like, just the depression of realizing that what the situation really is. And the way we repress and suppress that is really effective strategy. It's called distraction. And it is the defining characteristic of the world that we live in right now, and our culture and our society has never been more distracted. I mean, we have layers of distraction. You're distracted from your distractions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the way people are living their lives. And, I mean, So, coming back to, I live out west, and coming back to Chicago, where I'm from, and being with family over the holidays is a very poignant reminder of just how deep that level of distraction is. I remember the first time I told my nephews that I'd never played a video game, they were just like I was from a different planet. I don't play video games. You've never played Madden football and all these things. And I'm like, and here that just seems so bizarre. We and everything, but I mean, you know, the places that I've lived, it's not that unusual. But so I'm not dissing the Midwest, but you know, you folks are up against it here. But this—that's the national. That's our culture. And there's another interesting aspect to that from a clinic, from a psychological standpoint, and that is that, you know, the epidemic of depression and antidepressants, you know, for a long time became the most prescribed drug. You know what the most prescribed drug is today? Opioids. Painkillers have passed antidepressants as the most prescribed drug in America. And I have a hard time believing that there's more physical pain now than there, you know, that much more physical pain now than there was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And in fact, most of those opioids are not being written for legitimate purposes and end up in the streets. And so what it is psychological pain that people, those people for whom distraction is not an effective mask of the underlying depression, want to numb themselves out. And that's basically what opioids are good for. And we have an epidemic in opioids now. And we're talking about a combination of antidepressants and opioids of over 500,000 prescriptions in America every year, which means more than one for every man, woman, and child in America. And there's cultural expressions of these different stages as well. During the bargaining stage, when everyone, you know, when the corporations were reaching their full power and we had movies like Wall Street and Greed is Good and all that, you know, people were fascinated by vampires. And not just like not just vampires like we think of Bela Lugosi, the old style, but like just like that look like you and me, you know? So basically sucking the lifeblood out of the country. It was like a really apt metaphor for what was going on in this country in the 80s and 90s. And then all of a sudden it shifted to zombies. Now everybody is like fascinated by zombies and post-apocalyptic scenarios and so forth. So this is a way of like, it's like a type of national therapy to go see a movie like Interstellar or something, you know, where it's just like you start with the idea of a future being incredibly bleak and everything, and then there's the idea of overcoming that through impossible odds. But I think with the younger culture, especially the fascination with zombies and zombie nation, you know, it's very telling, you know, because they're having a really hard time seeing a lot of life in their future. And so the idea of the walking dead really appeals to them, resonates with them. Now, that's where we're at. And that sounds like, that might sound bleak to you, but from an eco-psychological perspective, from this perspective of someone who's been sort of working on these issues politically for most of my life, that's actually a really hopeful thing, because stage five, the final stage of grief, is acceptance. And when I speak about these different stages and what our national zeitgeist is right now is depression that's just underneath the surface, and we're acting in all these ways of avoiding it, I'm speaking in a sort of generalized terminology. Everybody individually is at different stages and goes from, you know, individually grief works through, it's not a linear process, and you can, you know, go back and forth and so forth. Collectively, it seems to be fairly linear, but at the same time, there's outliers, and there are millions of people already that are at that stage of acceptance, and they're the ones that are not in despair and that are not depressed by what's going on, but are actually taking constructive action. So this stage four of suppressed grief is not fatal, and it's actually the avoidance of it. You know, like fear is actually, we live in a fear-driven society, right? Fear is actually a form of intelligence. Fear is like what keeps us from walking off a cliff, right? Fear is not a negative thing. Unacknowledged fear is deadly. When you don't acknowledge your fears, then they control you. I mean, that's basic psychology. That's, you know, where shadows come from and so forth. Shadow psychology, you know, everything that we fail to acknowledge and we suppress causes problems, okay? But acknowledging fear and acknowledging this sort of natural depression is a very healthy thing. And so being aware that we have this underlying depression and confronting our fear of that depression and realizing that we're not talking about clinical depression for which there is no escape or which requires medical treatment, but rather we're talking about a natural response to the world situation, that if we can embrace that that type of depression and process through it, then we can get out of being stuck in it. And being stuck in it meaning being perpetually distracted and being like, you know, caught up in the national neuroses and psychoses, you know, like, or in despair. You know, despair is a form of unprocessed depression, right? So if we are able to recognize that we have that natural depression and bring it up and honor it with awareness, work through it, through grieving, and get ourselves to a stage of acceptance, then we can join in constructive action and constructive response, which to me is just as important, because I'm no longer a political activist. I'm no longer looking for political solutions to the climate crisis, because I don't think it's realistic. I think that what's realistic is what's happening at the community level and individual level, and you know that. Yeah, so it's underneath all of that dysfunctional stuff that's going up on top, that's covered on the news, you know, like all of that stuff, that underneath that, there's a growing community of people that are not depressed, that are aware, and that have accepted that we are in a, that we're going through a difficult period of time, and we're going to go through a difficult period of time, and we need to be prepared for that. So stage five, acceptance, is the only stage of grieving that's not dysfunctional and that you can't repress. There's no repressing acceptance, right? It's just this wonderful, and if anybody's ever done hospice work, when somebody gets to that level of acceptance of what's happening in their lives, then it becomes a beautiful spiritual experience. It's life-affirming. So this stage of acceptance represents a type of awakening. And I don't mean that in the Buddhist sense of awakening that we normally use it, but rather awakening from the American dream. And a social awakening. Fleet Mall is a Buddhist teacher who started the Prison Hospice Project. And he talks about social awakening, like what would awakening look like at a social level? So it's like taking care of each other, you know? Like just the things that we think of as compassionate action. And so through this, viewed through this lens, the question just becomes how do we get Americans and all those in the world that are afflicted by the American dream, since we've been so good at sharing that, from stage four to stage five. And it's just a question of attaining a critical mass. The solution to the climate crisis is truly a question of individuals changing their worldview one mind at a time. And when we reach that critical mass, whatever that is, then it happens all at once. But from a Buddhist perspective, this is so Huayan. This is so like, you know, there's no excuse for asking, oh, what can I do? I'm only one person. Because it's only one person at a time that's going to change the whole thing. And so we have ultimate responsibility. By changing our worldview and by working with our depression, our sort of share of that collective pot, that we can like change the flavor of the whole pot. And so then it becomes a psychological question or eco-psychology question. How do we help ourselves and help all others awaken? Because by helping ourselves awaken, we're feeding into that collective zeitgeist and changing that paradigm. So what I've just given you is the spiritual container for that transformation. Just the awareness of knowing where we're at and what the situation is and where everybody else is at and where we've come from and where we're going is a huge part of it. But at the same time, there's a lot of individual work we each need to do once we accept that responsibility for the collective consciousness or collective awareness. And part of that is, like I already said, recognizing that depression is natural and embracing that. And more active part of it is by actively grieving our losses. And we do this by bringing them into our awareness. And there's, you know, this is where ritual becomes important. And I can tell you, there, if you Google altars of extinction, you'll find some really helpful information there on how to bring the idea of what's happening with extinction and animal world and sentient beings into your Dharma practice. I have a very active altar at home, and it includes like an elephant and a tiger and an otter and a polar bear. You know, and I actually go down to this little toy store and find these like realistic looking little replicas of those animals that are threatened and endangered. And I bring them in and find those that like appeal to me, and I bring them onto my shrine and I meditate with them. And this is a form of shamanic practice. And something's actually happening there. I mean, you know, you are actually, even with species that are extinct, and when I do a public presentation, a visual presentation, I have a series of slides of species that have gone extinct and really have found some very touching photos of these no longer existing animals. And it's profound, the effect that it has, even on me when I do these presentations, but I see it in people as well, to bring that, to actively grieve that loss. These are species that we are no longer going to be able to share the world with. They're no longer part of our natural world, which means they're no longer part of us. But I think, you know, I say that literally, but I think from a Buddhist standpoint, from an eco-psychological standpoint, it is important. Just like with our relatives, we don't just forget them when they die, we don't just sort of like forget them and wipe out all the pictures and everything like that. We keep them alive through us. I know my father died when I was 19 years old, and he's very much, I still feel like he's very present. And I think that we have this responsibility to do this with the species that go extinct as well. We keep them alive within us, and they're a part of us. But they're, so grieving is something else that we have a lot of fear about, you know, but grieving is the other side of loving. It's a very natural response to life, and it's unfortunate that we've developed such a dysfunctional attitude towards grieving, but that's changing too, obviously. Hospice is a fairly recent development, and anybody who's ever done hospice work realizes that how much joy there is in grieving and dying. And it's because people are real at that time in life. People are so sweet at the end of their lives. It's just, it's amazing. And it's such an incredible privilege to share that process with people that are dying and have accepted the fact that they're dying. But at the same time, we need to balance that sort of heavy work, right? I mean, grieving, it's still kind of emotionally taxing, even if you're doing it in a healthy way. And so the other side of that coin is reconnecting with the natural world in whatever way we can and whatever way makes sense. And that doesn't mean that you have to like come out west and do a wilderness experience and a vision quest and all that. You know, I learned eco-psychology from a man, Craig Chalquist, in San Francisco, who has developed a subset of eco-psychology called terra-psychology, which is the our connection to place and how place basically has its own sort of spirit and consciousness. And he thinks, you know, like he's convinced that people that live in big cities have every much opportunity to connect to place and the spirit of a place and through nature as anybody else, you know, living out in, you know, on the ocean or whatever. And you can do that with just a tree, you know, like just picking a tree out that you can spend time with every day and sit under that tree. We happen to come from a tradition that values sitting under trees. So, you know, there's trees in the city, but also gardening, you know, and growing food is an incredible, with intention, is an incredible spiritual experience. And it's been shown now that the nutrients and bacteria in soil have greater antidepressant properties than pharmaceutical antidepressants. Hmm. Actually spending time with your hand in the earth is better than Zoloft? I don't know, what are the name of antidepressants?
Prozac.
Huh?
Prozac.
Yeah, Prozac. Better than Prozac. So, you know, the key is I think, you know, like with everything is intention and motivation underlying your intentions. And then I think finally, you know, it's really important to have courage to go into our fear and to recognize that anytime we have a visceral response to something about the climate or about extinction, it's basically there's fear there that that's unacknowledged. And rather than dwelling in the proliferation of distress and disturbing emotions, we have to go deeper and look at what is the fear here, you know. And I have, you know, for me, I also say we're all in denial. I don't buy this sort of dualistic idea of, like, you know, climate denialists and the climate realists or whatever. Like, you know, that's, I suppose, legitimate on some level. But the fact of the matter is that in order to function in life, we all have to manage our own denial. And again, like if you don't acknowledge that you're in denial to some extent on climate crisis, you know, every time you get in your car and drive or whatever, that there's some denial there, then it's a problem. But if you acknowledge that, you know, climate is really, it's a really tough time we live in right now. Things are heading in a really unfortunate direction. And there's this inconvenient 40-year time lag between what we do and how it is manifested in the environment and the climate, which means that we have 40 years of things getting worse at least. If you walk around thinking about that all the time, you can't function. You know, you just so we have to, like, manage our own psyche, and there are times when you have to confront that and deal with it and process it. And then there are times you have to just sort of, like, repress it, you know, and just, like, leave it below the surface and be okay with that. And so to me, that's constructive denial. You know, that's not a bad thing. But then, and that allows you then to have more freedom in your practice to work with fear and bring up those fears and put them in a Buddhist context. You know, I mean, as Buddhists, I became Buddhism in response to, you know, because I couldn't deal with environmental activism. I was a lawyer, and I was, like, you know, fighting for wildlife and everything, and it was just, you know, I was at that burnout stage. It's just so common because I didn't have the worldview, I didn't have the spiritual container in which to process all those emotions. And so I walked away from it for a number of years and went overseas and, you know, sort of experienced the natural world. And when I came back, I became Buddhist, and then I went back into environmental activism. I became very effective because I had the spiritual container and the worldview that allowed me to process that and to hold it, you know. And so we're very fortunate in that way. But these fears, you know, really go deep. And I have a really deep-seated fear right now of near-term human extinction. There are a lot of scientists out there talking about near-term human extinction. And I refuse to accept that. You know, I'm in totally denial. I mean, in denial about it. And underneath that denial is a really strong fear, you know. And it's hard for me to go into that, but it's helpful. You know, the more we're able to work with these things in our Dharma practice, the more effective we are in our action. So, and then it all comes down to don't know mind. You know, I mean that's been really, really helpful for me in writing about. I don't know what's going to happen 30 years from now. I think I do. I mean, I think I have some ideas about, you know, way things are going to go, but really I don't know. I was sitting and having breakfast one morning with my eco-psychology professor, Craig, before I came out here, before I moved away, and we had this funny talk about, I used to live near Yellowstone and was part of the bison, you know, helping, being an activist for bison. And so I have a lot of friends that live in the Yellowstone area, and we were talking about the Yellowstone caldera, you know, like this large active volcano under there that could blow at any time. And we had this funny conversation about, like, wouldn't it be interesting if the Yellowstone caldera blew 20 years from now, and the only reason we survived was because we had warmed the planet up enough that we were able to deal with the winter that resulted from this, you know. And that sounds preposterous, but it just, the point is not, you know, like, let's heat the planet up more in case the Yellowstone caldera blows and we have, you know, sort of that nuclear winter that results from it. But rather, Earth is a living, conscious being, and we don't know how she's going to respond to our irresponsibility, you know?
Yes.
And I have, you know, a lot of confidence and faith in not just Earth, but in humankind. And, you know, I get a lot of that from mythology. And the most prevalent myth of our time is overcoming impossible odds. It's what we do, it's what all of our movies are about, you know, it's all about overcoming impossible odds. And so the idea of near-term human extinction to me is a form of despair. I feel like it's a reverse kind of despair, like, oh, it doesn't matter, everything's, you know, gonna end anyhow. Something that I've seen with burnout before and stuff. So, okay, so I'm starting to. So, basically, cultivating compassion is the appropriate response to whatever disturbing emotions arise in response to the climate crisis. It's the appropriate response to the climate crisis itself. And then the final thing is redefining hope, which is something that we do in the hospice context with somebody once they have a terminal disease, like, you know, and they're no longer hoping for a miracle cure, then it's like, what are you hoping for? You know, and I think in the a lot of our despair in relation to climate crisis comes from having unrealistic hope that everything's going to be fine, everything's going to be okay, it's going to work out, and we're going to continue to just go on our merry way, you know, or there's going to be some miracle cure or something like that. You know, it's not. It's going to be a difficult transition from what we are now to what we're going to become. And so we have to be realistic about what it is we really hope for in the future. And the thing I hope for is that we just collectively awaken to a more compassionate state of being, and that's what's going to get us through whatever it is that we're facing.
Thank you very, very much, Jiwa. Very articulate and clear and
on some level encouraging presentation of where we're at. So I want to open this up for discussion. We have a little bit of time for that. Actually, for those of you who are used to our Sunday program, we're not going to do the formal temple cleaning this morning, so we have a little more time. We will have tea and cookies. But again, I just want to say that I really appreciate, you know, how clearly you present the situation we're in, and that what we're all doing here is working towards awareness, towards Sangha, working together, cooperating, collaborating, as opposed to the competitive and aggressive parts of the distraction complex that we're living in our
obsessive
society.
Obsessive compulsive distraction. That's an OCD.
Okay, yes, yes. The military industrial obsessive compulsive distraction. I'm sure a lot of people have responses and questions and comments. We have psychologists here. We have environmentalists here. Laurel, if I may, our Eno is a longtime director of urban conservation at the Field Museum until recently, and has worked. So part of what we talk about here is in climate, and then also that we do have an urban environment, and that through the cracks of the concrete, this awareness is there. It's there. So I just wanted to ask Laurel to start if you have any responses or comments.
Thank you very much for your talk. The part that I would emphasize by way of invitation to everyone is the part about connecting with nature and the city. And I would suggest three things: walking, bird watching, and going to the forest preserves. We have wonderful, wonderful nature here in the city, and it's right there, and people walk right by it. Just a few weeks ago, we had a huge sandhill crane migration over the city, and 10,000 gigantic, these are 4.5 foot tall birds, flew over downtown Chicago, and most people didn't even notice, and they were making a huge racket. And bird watchers were pointing out, and people were just going, a million people walked by, and 10,000 birds flew over, and they didn't even notice. It was so outstanding that they even made the news. But anyway, yeah, do connect with nature. It will make you happy.
And it will help heal the planet.
Yes, and now I have to apologize because I have people that I have to meet out in the prairie, and I have to leave just a little bit early, so thank you very much.
That's fine. Thank you, Laura. So, other people, we have a little bit of time, and then we'll have to time informally over tea and cookies, but anyone have any comments, questions, responses, please feel free. Jeremy.
I wanted to ask you how you, maybe some pointers as to how you manage don't know mind apathy that can result in buying maybe too much into don't know mind. Or, and also on the other side of that, maybe like an overzealous kind of like attitude towards this whole thing. Is that clear? Question.
Well, as far as like don't know mind aspect of that, it's just a question of being really clear on what it is that we know. I mean, and recognizing what is projection and what is not, and the like, you know. Yeah, even the things that we think we know are fraught with uncertainty. The IPCC, the International Panel of Climate, climate scientists, you know, they're all fixated on the 2% or 2 degrees Celsius, you know, rise in average global temperature. And what it's going to take to stay underneath and everything like that. And then, of course, their projections are constantly changing. You know, we know that we're at about 1 degree. We're approaching like 1 degree Celsius. and we know, we can look and see what the results of that are, the consequences. We have no idea what, you know, two degrees Celsius average temperature rise will bring about, and we have no idea when we're going to get there, and you know, or if we're going to get there. So everything, you know, everything from that, if you really follow closely in the science and everything, it can really be rather distressing. But then if you've been following it for a long time, you realize that these people are constantly changing the target. They're constantly changing their model. It's all based on models. It's a very inexact science, you know, I mean, and so they are in a position where they have to pretend like they know what's going on in order to influence the politicians. And then they are also in a position where they have to pretend, they have to cater their findings to politics. You know, it's just, there's a lot of hubris in science. I spent many years involved in litigation where you had scientists at a forest level, scientists on one side saying, oh, you know, everything's fine, everything's okay, and scientists on the other side saying everything's terrible, you can't do this, you know, and they're basically, you know, staking their reputations on what they were saying, and they were saying the opposite thing, and that's at a small micro level of a forest. So if science is that inexact at that small of a level, what is it like at a climate, at a global level? You know, the things they've been saying about even the, you know, about the ozone hole. You know, they've basically been representing that was all under control since the 80s, since the Montreal Protocol. It's not, you know, it's really not gotten any better, or, you know, it hasn't gotten significantly worse, but it hasn't improved or healed. So to me, it's like, how much utility is there into really placing a lot of emotional investment or a lot of time and energy into trying to find certainty there when there is none? And I think this is a problem that we have as human beings, is that we're desperately searching for certainty, and there isn't any. So the don't know mind is like it's, you know, it's important for me personally and for what I do to follow a lot of this science and stuff and follow the latest news from the Arctic, you know, and about methane and everything like that. But to hear scientists saying, oh, this means this and this means that, you know, I take all of that with a real grain of salt. Science is like a religion almost with us. You know, we place so much faith in science, and it's not worthy of it. It's a very inexact thing. And so you just sort of recognize the whole spectrum. Oh, you have scientists saying this, and you have scientists saying that, blah, 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 blah. You know, we're talking about managing risk, you know, we're talking about, and this is why I don't think it's not a scientific issue. It's not like we're going to resolve this through science or politics or anything else. It's about how we relate to nature and to natural world and what our worldview is. Once that changes, everything changes.
Yes.
And so that's more important. There's an amazing book out right now called The More Beautiful World Our Heart Knows Is Possible. And it's by an eco-philosopher and also an economist. And the whole book is basically about our worldview and how the worldview not only needs to change, but it is changing from the idea of like separation, that we're separate from our environment, to the fact that we're totally integrated with it. The only science I find really helpful is like quantum science and, you know, quantum physics and stuff, because that's like changing, that's all about like how things, that comes closer to how things really exist, and how interrelated and interconnected and interdependent everything is. But then I can go back to the Hua Yan and say, well, it's all there.
Yeah, and that, that modern physics really breaks through our usual way of seeing things. So it's very helpful that way. So I do want to give time for a few other people have comments or responses, and there'll be time informally afterwards. But George, yes.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you for your work and for the great presentation you gave here today.
Sure.
Your model applying the grief process makes total sense to me in terms of my own inner experience. I'm working on a book. You have a title for that and a time that might be out.
Yes, plug it, yes.
Yeah, the working title is Planetary Hospice, a Compassionate Response to Our Climate in Crisis. I'm planning on having it finished in the spring and hopefully be out by the end of the year.
Okay. Yeah, sure. And this presentation here today will be on the website?
Hopefully, yes.
Okay.
Other responses, comments? We have psychologists here. Yes, please.
You were saying that you were disappointed with the activist work that you were doing before and kind of left that and went overseas and got into Buddhist practice and realized it was more about a kind of compassionate work with others, and that if there's change, it has to be from the community, kind of like from the bottom up. Can you give examples of what that looks like?
Of what it looks like?
Yeah, how you've experienced that or witnessed that happening.
Well, you know, I lived for, until recently, I was in the Bay Area in California for a couple of years and studying, you know, working on a degree. And I became friends with Joanna Macy, who has been doing this work for a long time.
And was here a couple of years ago.
She was? Yeah. And who started out as a nuclear, anti-nuclear activist. So I think that she has a new book called Active Hope, and which would, you know, give a lot of examples of in response to your question. But for me personally, it's hard to like give specific examples. It's more of just the experiencing the cultural shifts that are happening in the Bay Area and with younger people in particular. A lot of it, interestingly enough, seems to be happening around entheogenic substances, you know, like ayahuasca and things like that, like people having doing sacred ceremony with basically shamanic kind of practices, and then from that sort of transformative perspective, structuring their lives in ways that they feel can withstand whatever's coming. So through permaculture and living in intentional communities, I've seen that in Oregon as well. So the people that are just starting to get closer to the land, I think farmers markets are actually a really good example of this happening. I personally feel like that. And I just was at a Mind and Life conference in Boston last month, and we had a talk about this, like recognizing the urgency of the situation. What can we do? You know, like where is this transformation going to happen that we're talking about, the social transformation? And I'm convinced it's going to happen in our relationship to food. because, you know, and we can actually, we have all the technology, quote unquote, we need to solve the environmental crisis or the climate crisis right now.
Yes.
All it takes is like is ditching agribusiness and going back to permaculture or organic farms. If everybody switched to organic food tomorrow and there was no more demand for GMO and all the other nonsense, not only would we be able to feed the world, not only would we be healthier, but organic farming, it's been now shown through studies, actually takes carbon out of the atmosphere. So we could reverse, and this is something that we are going to have to do because of the amount of carbon that's already been emitted. We need to, in order to survive and to actually avoid catastrophic consequences, we need to know how to take carbon out of the climate. And we can do that through soil cultivation. So I think, I know, like, from, you know, I've always sort of seen Chicago and my family out here and everything, which is more the suburbs, right? As sort of this is the middle of America. This is kind of like how culture is in America. And my brother's a vegetarian now. He's a truck driver. He's a vegetarian. My goddaughter and niece, who, you know, a young mother and school teacher, is going vegan. You know, people are really changing the way they think about the relationship to food. I think that's the biggest sign of hope for me. The more and more people cut down, like, I, you know, I'm vegetarian, but I don't preach vegetarianism to people. I'm like, I preach being mindful about what you're eating and knowing where it's coming from and knowing that it's not coming from a factory farm. Everybody can relate to that. And then recognizing the relationship of your food to the climate and cutting down your meat intake, you know, just getting red meat out of your diet, finding alternatives. You know, you don't have to become vegetarian, you just have to, like, get with it, you know.
Can I respond further to your question about how to see the possibilities of change and hope? You know, one thing is to look at how change happens. It doesn't happen, as you were saying, through politicians, you know, passing laws or whatever, but through many people working on many levels for a long time. So there are clear examples. The Berlin Wall coming down, the Soviet Union breaking up, apartheid ending in South Africa, all of which happened seemingly very suddenly. Experts couldn't have predicted the Berlin Wall coming down a month before. There's another resource besides Zhiwa's wonderful work, Naomi Klein's book, Climate, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus Climate. She talks about these changes that happen on the structural level of society that don't, you know, like well, the Berlin Wall is one example. Another example, excuse me to any of you who are smokers, but the fact that culturally tobacco became, which was glamorous and wonderful when I was growing up, is now, you know, not culturally, you know, cool, you know. So, and then I want to add to that, you mentioned Joanna Macy. She has a wonderful way of putting it that I've talked about here a lot, that she talks about the great turning, which is happening under the surface of the mass media and corporate world. And she talks about that in three modes, which we're all involved in. One of them is what Jiwo was just talking about in terms of agriculture, but alternative structures. So farmers markets is a good version of that. Regional financial and agricultural systems, that's one. She also talks about holding actions, which is what we can still do in the political realm and also in terms of social work, helping the damage that's, and distress that is happening physically in the world, that we can still, you know, they may not listen, but if enough people march in the streets of America about climate change, eventually they will have to make changes. So that's just, those are holding actions. That's one aspect. The other one is very much what we're doing here, which is and also what you were referring to, which is changing our worldview. And this happens through meditation practice. So the other example of you asked how Jiwa has seen this, one way that I can testify to is the way that meditative practice actually changes and transforms people. And I've seen it in myself, and I've seen it in many people here, and that some kind of spiritual physical practice actually opens up this kind of awareness, this Huayan awareness of how we're interconnected. Changing the way people see reality will change all of this, will allow practical responses. So so I just wanted to say that in response to your very fine question, and I want to thank Jiwa again. We're going to have a chance for tea and more informal discussion, but let's close formally now with the four bodhisattva vows, which are on in the chant card that some of you have. We chant them three times.
Beings are numberless. I vow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to rend them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to end them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.
So
just hit the record button.